RN, your daily commute companion.
Good morning, I'm Michael Cathcart. Whether you're podcasting, listening on your phone or on your radio, you are so very welcome to a brand new week of books and arts here on RN. Today you'll meet the internationally renowned printmaker David Fraser. He tells us about the allure of the woodcut. I reckon his work is a little bit like looking into someone else's dreams. And you'll discover the connection between Korea and the sleepy Victorian town of Clunes. The key to this story is a photographer named George Rose, who was born in Clunes during the gold rush.
The guy had a fantastic eye, and he took photographs in Korea in 1904 when everything else was being destroyed.
But first, you've heard of creationism, but what is curationism? Now, I've long thought that a curator is a person who puts together an art show or organises a display in a museum. In fact, listener, the term gives me the willies, and I was rather hoping that it would die out, but it turns out that it's spreading. There are curators everywhere. You can curate a music playlist. I have friends who are curating photographs on Instagram. Apparently, you can curate a menu at a dinner party. Well, our next guest understands what this is all about. He's David Balter. He's a Canadian art critic, and he's the author of Curationism, How Curating Took Over the Art World and Everything Else. And he joins us on the phone from London. Hello, David.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. It must have been a sweet night when you thought up that word, curationism. You must have been punching the air.
I don't know how it happened, but it did happen.
It's magic. So curators are everywhere in the culture. How did this happen?
Well, I can't explain it in any kind of direct or logical sense, but the purpose of my book is to draw a parallel between what has happened, I guess, exponentially in popular culture and what had happened in the art world, because, of course, in the art world, we've been talking about this for a while. Since the 1990s, the curator really ascended and sort of took over as this figure of prominence, perhaps even a religious prominence. So this ubiquity of the curator has been on our minds for a long time. And I wanted to make a connection between what had happened in the art world with the curator and then carry it over to what has happened in popular culture and actually try to take the air out of some people who think that the word curator has been abused and really quite seriously try to make a case for the popular culture use of the term as being somehow related to the art world use of the term.
So when you say there are people who think the word has been abused, you mean there are people in the art world who have a lofty sense of what curators do, what their mission is on earth, and there's a kind of vulgarity that is debasing the role. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, that the role has somehow been perverted and has been taken out, unfairly taken out of its professional context.
So what does it mean? I mean, curating, it sounds as though it's some sort of Latin word. Does it come from a Latin root?
Yes, it has a Latin derivation. In the book, I go all the way back to ancient Rome. And in ancient Rome, there were curatores who were in charge of public work. So you had, say, sort of a curatore of the water system or the aqueducts. And it was largely an honorific position, but it did involve that aspect of caretaking. And cura in Latin means to care for something. But it also means the word curious also has the same root. So it means also to take an interest in something. So to care about something and also to take an interest in it.
So that old-fashioned word, curate, which is a sort of church functionary, someone who helps the vicar, I think, is the curate. Is that in the same etymological ballpark?
It is indeed, because the church curate or the parish priest is in charge of caring for a particular sort of subset or parish, you know, indeed, of the church. And one thing to keep in mind about the church curate is that traditionally the curate is in a lower position and is somebody who's sort of responsible for answering to superiors, which is, of course, where the phrase curate's egg comes in, which derives from a satirical comic from the 19th century in which a church curate is sitting at a restaurant with his betters and has cracked open a bad egg and is trying to assure his betters that the egg is good. So this kind of, that moment, that satirical moment in the comic actually is kind of a telling thing for me because it suggests the curator performs value and sometimes performs it when the value isn't even there.
Ah, now, okay, let's get into the critical edge of what you've got to say. So you say that the museum curators, of which we speak so often, and often with such reverence, they appeared, what, in the 80s or the 90s? And it occurs to me that this is at the same time as the rise of postmodernism, and that maybe curators are born, well, you know, with postmodernism already on their tongues.
Yeah, well, what I'm interested in is the contemporary curator and that idea. And when I say contemporary, I don't mean that we can dehistoricize it. I do tell a historical story of the contemporary curator, but take it back from the 1980s and then put it in the 1960s and the 1970s when the idea of conceptual art first emerged. And there is where we see the origin, because at that point, the idea of a work of art became more important than the actual physical object. So what you have then are curators needing to be there to advocate for this very strange kind of nebulous work that's coming out of the art world that can't really be pinned down. So we have sort of land art, installation art, emerging performance art, and it can't be really shown in a museum in a proper way that normal, quote-unquote, normal modernist art could have been, such as in the Museum of Modern Art. So the curator kind of makes that real and performs the value of those things. And, you know, all of those things, kind of as rebellious as they were kind of absorbed by the institution in the 1990s, a very beleaguered art institution, you know, lacking funding, and as a way to draw audiences to that institution. And, of course, you know, performance art is particularly interesting because the use of the verb to curate, as in I'm curating something, I'm curating a festival, I'm curating an outfit. The OED traces that usage only back to the early 1980s, and it's actually found in a New York Times citation about performance art. So performance and curating are, like, very, very much connected in my mind.
So the curator is a kind of cultural go-between between the art world and the rest of us poor sods who don't quite know what's going on.
And it's hyper-conscious of an audience looking at what they're doing. And that, of course, brings us to the present contemporary use of curating, where we're all curating online, we're curating our personae on Facebook or whatever, and we're hyper-aware of an audience looking at us.
Now, have you said all this, David, because you want to throw some kind of critical light on the role of the curator? You want to call it into question, or are you celebrating it?
I'm definitely not celebrating it, but I think it's really important to note, especially in the context of the art world, where, say, unlike the fashion world, where there's an acknowledgement that what you're doing is you're not only making something creative, but you're selling a product and you're part of the capitalist system. In the art world, we're kind of terrified to admit that there's actually a market present. And whenever the market is discussed, we all kind of blanch and think that we're better than it. But the fact of the matter is that even the avant-garde and the idea of the avant-garde, meaning like keep putting up new things, new and better things, what's in, what's out, what's the latest trend, that is, you know, inherently capitalist. And the idea of the curator is kind of at the heart of the way we understand capitalism now. So the criticism just lies in my attempt to describe the moment that we're in and my attempt to make sure that people in the art world don't forget that we're also, in a way, selling product and advocating for product, and we are within milieu of consumption.
Are you accusing the advocates or the supporters, the celebrators of the curators of a kind of bad faith, that they see themselves as lofty, but you're saying in some ways they're like auctioneers?
Well, you know, everyone who works in a creative field, you have to believe in what you're doing. And it's not necessarily, I'm not attributing any particular attitude to a curator. I'm more talking about the mythology that's surrounding the curator, and that's the problem. And, you know, some curators subscribe to that, and some curators don't. Some curators work in a very humble and traditional and actually very dedicated manner to really try to bring ideas and artists out into the light. But there are also some curators now working who really function along a similar lines as sort of politicians or CEOs, as being spokespeople. And I don't know how self-aware those people are, but it's important to just acknowledge that they're working within those patterns. They're occupying that space.
David, as a presenter of an art show, I've certainly encountered curators who have spoken as though the world needs them because artists are unable to speak for themselves. They think of visual artists as being a bit naive in the way they talk. And as you know, often you'll talk to a painter and the painter will say, well, the reason I painted this picture is because I really like that red over there in the hills and I wanted to get that rich red colour. And it doesn't sound all that sophisticated. So a curator comes along with a kind of much more conceptualized notion of what the painting was all about and what the poor old artist's real intention was, even though he just thought he was trying to get the lovely red right.
Yeah. And some curators can definitely help artists, and some artists will be the first to admit that their work was greatly aided and advocated for by a curator. And sometimes it's the same thing as a writer as well. You know, when you're an art critic and you deal with certain artists, they can't talk about their work. They don't know how to talk about it, even though you like it. So then you're enlisted to do that job. But there are also some artists whose work really speaks for itself. And there are a lot of exhibitions that happen nowadays where, because the curator wants to ascertain so much power, that you get these over-curated shows and over-explained shows with too many didactic panels. They're arranged in thematic ways where they really should just be arranged chronologically according to when the artist was creating, how the artist was creating. And it's fussy. It's an over-fussiness that I think should be pretty much an object of critique. But the whole thing about the curator is this negotiation between, is the curator wanted or needed? And that's, you know, you can't say one or the other. That's kind of one of the many paradoxes of curating, is a want or a need.
The role of curator you're describing there reminds me of the role of the auteur director in theatre, a person who's determined to put him or herself at the top of the billing, really ahead of the artist sometimes.
Exactly. And the same thing can be said of the film world, and the same thing happened at the same time in the film world, where this auteurist figure of the director emerged to author the film. And our obsession with authorship, I think, is rather problematic. Even in terms of, I mean, we can talk about it in terms of artistic creation, but when you have these clear group efforts, such as putting on an exhibition or making a film or putting on a play, it's really hard to attribute one author to it. So in that sense, we sort of fetishize the authorial. And I think taking that back to my idea of the anxious curator, we want to be able to attribute actions to one person because it kind of gives us a sense of comfort that somebody's in control. And it also gives us a way to talk about things in a concrete manner.
And David Balza is a Canadian art critic. He's the author of Curationism, How Curating Took Over the Art World and Everything Else. It's published by Pluto Press. And I'd love to know what you think. Do curators have too much power, do you reckon? Or are they the energy of public art shows? Are they, you know, keeping the whole thing moving? You can email us through our website or you can tweet us. We're at RN Books and Arts. You can tweet me directly if you like. I'm Cathcart Michael, at Cathcart Michael on Twitter. And, of course, our Facebook is there. You can chat to us on Facebook if you like as well. Next up, a wonderful artist speaks very eloquently for himself.
I'm going okay, taking it day by day. You know what they say, can't complain. It's just these little aches and pains. I got them all. Sunshine or rain.
Well, David Fraser is an internationally renowned artist who specializes in wood engravings and lino cuts. He also does lithography and etchings and paintings. And his woodcuts and lino cuts are heart-stoppingly beautiful, like pictures out of a storybook from, well, long ago. They're quite old-fashioned looking to my eye in their level of skill, and yet they feel totally of our time. He's had over 40 shows. He's exhibited in Australia and in London and China, all over the place. And he's collaborated with singer-songwriter Paul Kelly on a book of woodcuts, based on the song Little Aches and Pains, the song we've just been listening to. Now, he's participating in a group show of lino cuts and woodcuts at the Beaver Gallery in Canberra, and the show is called appropriately Cuts, and it coincides with the 8th Australian Print Symposium at the National Gallery of Australia. There's a link to that on our website. So, David, it's lovely to have you in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Now, as you've walked in, you've handed me two little blocks, which I take it are... Well, what are they?
They're wood engravings.
Right.
Glorified potato cuts. Well, you're holding a beautiful N-grain piece of English boxwood,
yes,
which is a very slow-growing hedge tree. And I've engraved marks into the end grain. It's a relief print, so everything that I engrave will be white. The surface holds the ink and takes the image, and paper on top in the press, and you have a print. And that's the way they used to illustrate books and newspapers.
That's why it looks old-fashioned to my eye, because I'm recognising this as a style I recognise from, say, Smith's Weekly in the olden days, or
yes,
books of my childhood. So this thing I'm holding, that's what you print the image with, is it?
So it's just a beautiful object in itself. So there's no processes like etching where you have to put things in acid baths and so on. Basically, you have your piece of wood, tool, and you just cut into it, roll ink on top, paper, bam, you've got there's
now,
your
listen,
print.
Now, this image I'm holding, which is roughly in a heart shape, is of two people, a man and a woman, disappearing down a path with trees around them and clouds in the sky and very detailed little grass. And I can't, and a beautiful hatching on the trees. So you have shaved all this or carved out all these sections with just a very sharp instrument.
That's right. Just a little engraving tool. It's a very anal pastime. I'm a little bit borderline OCD.
Anal is the word I would have thought but not been prepared to say. So are you wearing magnifying glasses?
I've got glasses. Sometimes I put on those ones from the chemist that magnify things. My eyes are deteriorating, so I need stronger glasses. But it is pretty intensive. You're crouched over this little piece of wood. But I mean, I do, that is highly detailed. But if you look at some of the engravings they did back in the olden days, it was a trade. It was a job like any other job. And the level of detail they would get was just phenomenal.
And it's quite different, the outcome, from what you could do with a pen and ink. I mean, this is what surprises me. You'd think that if you could look at an engraving and see what the technique looks like, if you got a dip pen and some, black Indian ink, you could sort of shortcut it and just draw it, but you can't get that effect.
No. Back in the very olden days, people would do black line engraving. People would come in with a pen and ink drawing, like a quill ink drawing, and the engravers would very carefully cut out all the little bits of white around the black, leaving black marks to give the impression of a black and white pen drawing. Early 1800s, Thomas Buick, who was the king of sort of modern engraving, he sort of started doing white line engraving, which is basically like drawing with a white pen on black paper, if that makes any sense.
Yes, it does. Yeah. So you're creating the image by taking away.
Mm.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like walking into a dark black room and slowly dimming the lights on.
Anyway, look at the website, because there's some images of David's work up there. And as you'll see, they do look like something out of a storybook. The woodcut has this kind of sort of primitive energy.
Well, it's something that nothing ever competes with. Something you print out of an inkjet print just does not get doesn't come close to the effect. This embosses into the paper, and the typeset when you do text, the little lead letters, it embosses into the paper, and there's this imperfection, which is just a beautiful thing, and it's so tactile.
How did you get into this?
Well, it's a bit of a long story. I studied painting initially. I had very good art teachers at school, and I just never did printmaking. So I just went to art school. I just did painting. And I struggled along there, and for about a year after art school, I continued painting these awful paintings, not knowing what to paint and how to paint. And then after that, I gave that away. I wanted to be a songwriter, and I wanted to do sing songs and be universally loved and adored.
Yeah, me too.
So I gave away the art, and I started singing in bands and so on. But I couldn't write songs, unfortunately, except for the odd ditty. And I ended up becoming a karaoke act. And so I was riding the karaoke boom in the early 90s in Bendigo, working five nights a week.
That's the big time, karaoke in Bendigo.
Running a karaoke show. And then I supported a local covers band at the Theatre Royal in Castlemaine called Sea Red, very odd billing, and I was just singing my cabaret songs with my backing tapes, and there was 15 people in the audience. 14 of those were the boys from the Castle Bacon, who spent my entire performance screaming abuse at me and chucking ice blocks at me. And then the final gig I ever did was outside a cafe in Sale in Gippsland, spruiking business for a cafe dressed as a gorilla. And I did that for a couple of hours, and then I was just too humiliating, and I thought, I can't get any lower than this.
One shit in an animal suit advertising someone else's business.
Yeah.
It's time to take stock.
It is.
I'm with apologies to that chap who is the early bird, the blue early bird that tries to get people to park at that early bird car park in the city where I live.
Well, I'm sure it's an honourable job, but it wasn't really how the dream was meant to be.
No.
And so I packed the monkey suit up. And I was nearing 30, and I thought, I've got to do something with my life. So I thought maybe art, it's time to get back in trying to do art. So I had discovered lino cuts in the previous couple of years, and I was cutting them at home and printing on the kitchen table printing with the back of a spoon. I discovered etching, and I really enjoyed the process, and it sort of suited me better than painting. So I decided to go back to art school, and I did an honours year at Monash Caulfield in 96 in printmaking.
So that's in Melbourne.
Yes, and I was very lucky it was a very vibrant studio at the time, and there was lots of really cool happening artist printmakers, and I was introduced to wood engraving. And immediately, the first engraving I did, I just instantly fell in love with it. And I found that it was the closest thing, funnily enough, it was the closest thing to writing a song that I've ever found. It really suited poetry and text and narrative, which I love.
Oh, pursue this thought more. How is engraving a block of wood or cutting stuff out of lino like writing a song?
Well, some of these images you see of mine as engravings, you do them as a painting, and believe me, I tried. It just looks a bit twee and illustrative. It doesn't really work as a painting. But as a print, as a little print, they're very intimate wood engravings. You have to be very close to them. You have to get right up to them to look at them. And I suppose because their history of illustrating books and newspapers, they're very suited to poetic titles text.
So they're like a little pop song.
Yes, they are. And then I would discover if I did a whole series of them and then add some text with the typeset and then stitch them all together, I could make a book, which is a bit like a record album or something.
I totally get this. Even this little one we started talking about, you know, and a boy and a girl are walking down the path in the forest at night. That's a pop song.
Mm.
You know, you and me in a forest at night.
So everything I do now, I do think like a songwriter, even though I couldn't actually write a song.
So you bought a book.
See this book here. It becomes a beautiful thing.
Lovely book that you've just handed me is called Little Aches and Pains, which is a reference to the music we played at the top of this story. David Fraser, your name on the front, and Paul Kelly. So tell us about this collaboration that you've embarked on with Paul Kelly, the songwriter.
Well, I'd done quite a few books myself, but I don't have a massive imagination. I was basically just doing variations of the one story, and I just wanted to do something else with someone else's words. I tried a few times novelists. I got close to Tim Winton once, but didn't get across the line. And I think maybe if novelists are a little bit more precious with their words or their writing, I didn't ever have any luck with novelists, but then I...
Well, I think novelists believe they paint the picture with words.
They probably
don't want an illustration getting in the way.
Yeah. Whereas with pop rock singers or what have you, songwriters, I think they're more used to collaboration and people interpreting their stuff, and maybe they like the idea of being involved with a, you know, fine artist or something. I don't know. But I became friends with the keyboard player, Cameron Bruce, in Paul Kelly's band. And so I sent him an email to Paul via Cameron, and Paul replied, and he just said, yes, no
let's
problem,
do this.
Let's do it. So it was great. And
So what's the relationship between this book and the music?
Well, I basically interpreted the song. So every line from the song, it's basically the entirety of the song. And he's gave me free rein to just interpret the song.
So instead of a video clip, we've got a woodcut book.
That's right.
You could have this on Rage at Night with someone turning the pages at the appropriate moment.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, come on, ABC. Fork out and we'll do this. I'll be the page turner. I'll do it for nothing. There you are. That's how keen I am to see this on Rage in the middle of the night. So, listener, this is the most beautiful book. So when you pick it up, it just looks like a book's got a lovely cover. But you're not really prepared for the beautiful surprise that lies inside, because what you've got is beautiful, rich artist's paper, which is, you know, roughly cut along the edges so you really feel as though you're dealing with an artwork. And on every page, only on the right-hand side of the page, you've got these delicate little woodcuts that are just, oh, I don't know, what's that, sort of 3 or 4 centimetres across, of just these lovely little pictures. So there's a lady standing at the bottom of a lighthouse, all black and white. There's a lady cuddling a man in bed with the line underneath, disabled, we're born, disabled, we die. And so it goes. They really are beautiful. Where do you work?
I've got a studio in Castlemaine at my where I live, and I have a beautiful, I print these on this most beautiful press from the 1850s called a Columbian, which is a hand platen press. It's all covered in gold eagles and serpents, and I've even got a Cupid on it for some reason.
Well,
beautiful.
Because you love it.
Yeah, well, it's beautiful. Built in 1850s, looks beautiful and still works like it's brand new.
So where does someone get hold of a 1850 Columbian?
Well, they're very rare, very hard to get. I was just browsing on eBay one day, and there I saw it.
It was on eBay.
It was on, yeah.
Did it arrive through Australia Post?
Unfortunately, with all these beautiful old presses, they weigh half a ton to a ton.
That's
so
what
you
I
need
thought.
Crane trucks. Yeah, all my friends always hate it whenever I moved.
This is just the most lovely gig that you've sorted out for yourself.
And I'm very lucky.
Oh, well, you're also very, very talented, which is why you're able to do it. So the Beaver Gallery in Canberra is holding an exhibition of work by 4 printmakers, and you're in there. Mm-hmm. Along with you is Diane Fogwell, John Schlitz, and G.W. Bott. And the 4 of you actually have quite different styles. It's quite interesting, quite staggering to see that the same sort of technique can produce such different effects. Now, your one work in this is called Together Alone, which I've been looking at reproductions of, and it's vast.
It's pretty big. It's a very big lino cut, but I've recently taken on doing the big lino cut. So in 2007, I won this international print biennale in China. And since then, I've been going back regularly. They seem to be on the assumption I'm a world-famous artist, and they treat me like visiting president, which is kind of fun.
Well, that's good. That works.
But the last couple of two trips back, I was noticing these guys, all these guys doing these huge woodcuts on plywood, and I thought I could give that a go. So when I got back, I started this huge lino cut that was 1.5 metres tall by 1 metre wide almost. When I started picking away, I'd forgotten how anal I was, and I thought, my God, I'm going to be here for years cutting this. Ended up taking 3 months. And I've found if you do lino cuts, you can't quite get the same level of detail as on a wood engraving, but if you make the lino cut big, you step back and it just looks like a huge engraving. The one in the show, Together Alone, was the lino cut I did after that big one.
So this is again in this bold black and white effect that you get. It's a man and a woman. Well, they're a statue, I guess.
Sort of a statue,
they could be a statue. They could be real, standing on a plinth. And they're in a beautifully formally laid out park. And there's a lot of other, you suddenly realise there are a lot of other people in the park, all of whom are alone. And they're looking a little bit oppressed, most of them. Although there are a couple cuddling, there are a lot of people who are alone.
And half of them are on their iPads and iPhones.
I can't see that level of detail. But that's in your imagination. You're imagining that, are you?
No, it's they're in the...
You can see that, can you?
That's a small reproduction.
I'm looking at a small reproduction. I haven't got
the
full metre by 1.5 metres there. I mean, is there some autobiography here in this? Were you feeling alone in the park of life at this stage?
Oh, no. There's always elements of biography. I fictionalise things.
But there are a lot of men in your pictures who do seem to be alone.
A lot of confused and bewildered men, which is a very fertile subject.
But is there some, I mean, to be serious for a moment, are you confronting your own confusions here?
Or? I'm always confused.
Does it help?
Oh, it helps artistically.
Okay. But the deeper issues that you're nursing in your soul.
Well, I try to make them generalised, and I try to make it so people can, of all persuasions, can connect and relate to these themes, and they seem to, which is good.
Yeah. So you've had this expression of making the, not the video clip, we'll have to find a term for this, the woodcut clip that goes with a Paul Kelly song. Is there another musician you'd like to have a crack at?
Well, the next one I'm working with is Don Walker, who is the genius songwriter from Cold Chisel. And he's done several solo albums since. So there's about 30 songs of his I'd like to do. I'm doing one I'm starting one soon, one of his songs called Silos, and I'm also trying to talk him into actually maybe looking at one of my pieces and writing something new.
But so David, 30 can, songs, that'll see you out.
I could do that forever. So I had to just come down and pick to do one, and yeah, trying to get him to write something new so it would be a complete collaboration.
Mm. Well, hopefully. Look, it's been lovely to meet you, and such beautiful work. It's just a joy and a privilege actually to handle the actual block that you use to make these prints. It's just so exquisite. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks.
David Fraser. And if you want to see his show, if you're in Canberra, you can check it out at the Beaver Gallery, which is in Denison Street there in Deakin. And if you'd like to comment on any of the things that David said there, you can just join the conversation on Facebook and you'll find a link there to David's website. You're on Books and Arts. We're on air. We're online and we're on your ABC radio app.
One of my favourite toponyms is one called Pooh Bear's Corner.
If you go down in the woods...
Toponyms, place names, they raise some pretty strange questions. How did a facial hair-themed parody rock band get involved in a suburban naming dispute in regional Victoria? Why would a beach in Queensland have links to a meat extract and Nazi occultism? Place names. Join me, Tiger Webb, for a series that's all about the stories our names tell. RN Showcase, online at the RN website.
Well, one of Britain's best-loved crime writers, the legendary Ruth Rendell, has died over the weekend, aged 85. She was the author of over 60 novels, and many of them featured her best-known protagonist, Chief Inspector Reginald Wexford. Over her 50-year career, Rendell won three prestigious Edgar Awards from the Mystery Writers of America. She also won four gold daggers and a diamond dagger from England's Crime Writers Association. And her death comes just 6 months after that of fellow crime writer P.D. James, who was a good friend. They were also political opponents because they both sat in the House of Lords on opposite sides of the Speaker. In 2009, the two writers sat down together at the Cheltenham Literary Festival in the UK. And they talked about their work. This conversation begins with P.D. James asking Ruth Rendell how she came up with the character of Inspector Wexford and how her writing career began.
I wrote several novels. I either finished them or didn't finish them. And they were when I was in my 20s. And I think it was sort of apprentice work. It was practice. I was finding out how to do it. And I didn't send any of these works, these sort of embryo manuscripts or just trials, things I was trying out, to publishers. I did nothing with them. I kept them. And at last the time came to try one. Now, my husband was then working for the Daily Mail, and his book page editor suggested that first he asked what I should do with these things, and the book page editor said there are too many books already, we'll give her a job on the Daily Mail. Well, I didn't want to work for the Daily Mail. So he suggested that he said don't do it, I can't give you any help, but you try sending it to those who are still my publishers after 45 years. And I had written a detective story just to see if I could do it, I think, for fun, really. I think it was a very good plot. That's all I can say for it. And it did introduce Wexford. Not as a full-blown character, not a character I'd studied at all, but simply because I needed to have an investigating officer. So then Wexford was born. They took it. They took it after months and months of looking at it. They asked me to do a lot of rewriting. I did over Christmas 1963. And they took it. And they paid me for it a princely sum of £75, which wasn't very much even in 1964. But it was the beginning. And I did earn a lot more later on with... not very much longer later on either, but I've always thought of this tiny amount of money that I had for that first book, which, when the first editions of it fetch about, you know, a first edition of that from Doom with Death fetches about £2,000, which is quite funny. But now I know that you started off very differently, so I think you should tell us how you began, Phyllis.
But it's interesting, Ruth, we both started with our detective. I mean, I had wondered whether you had started, you know, with more of a Barbara Vine and had come to Wexford. But your first published book had Wexford, and my first published book had Dalgate. I knew much earlier, I think, that I wanted to write. And it never occurred to me to begin with anything other than a detective story, because I liked reading them so much as a girl and as a young woman, and I thought I could do it, you know, and if I could do it, it would stand a good chance of being accepted. I settled down to it, and it took a long time. I began in my middle 30s. I should have started earlier, but all sorts of things were against me. I was 19 when the war broke out, and my husband came back ill from service in the Royal Army Medical Corps, and I, by then, had two small girls and a sick husband to support. So I needed to do something very safe with a cheque at the end of each month. But I began because I realised that there never was going to be a convenient time to begin. It was just too silly going on, sort of plotting and planning and thinking and imagining what it would be like to be a writer and not actually doing it. So I settled down and did it. I got mine accepted rather more quickly, but we both, we both began without a rejection slip, but of course we did, because otherwise it wouldn't be published if we'd had a rejection slip. But it was when I had the telephone call from my agent saying that the book had been accepted by Faber and Faber. That was really one of the great moments of life. It was even more exciting than when the first books appeared. Do you remember that actual moment?
I do remember that actual moment, and I agree with you that it is more exciting. When the book appears, I think you worry. You begin to worry how it will do, what any reviewers, if there are any who will be interested in it, what they will say, what readers will think. But I think when it's first accepted, it's a wonderful feeling.
It is, yes.
Just at that time, it's wonderful. I think it's very interesting what you say about thinking it's no good putting it off. You must do it. People often do put things off, and you get that rather sad situation then when they say, oh, well, I knew I could have done whatever it happens to be, and I did, but I kept thinking now's not the time, and putting it off, and they never do it. But you have to do it, don't you?
You have to make yourself do it. Though there are those irritating people who say, well, of course I'd like to write, but frankly I haven't the time. As if they would, you know, if only they would do it, then they would have a bestseller on their hands. Sort of feeling that, you know.
But they also say that is also a reason for their not reading. They don't have time to read either. Not, of course, anybody who is in our audience today. Yes. They're all prolific readers.
Absolutely. It's interesting, Wexford, you see, because you said you began and you just had to have an investigating officer. So indeed one does, of course. But was it really rather lucky in a way, Ruth, that you did hit on someone at the very beginning who has become so important, so successful, so loved by everybody, and who you could develop? I mean, it was a stroke of luck in a way, because you've been very happy to stay with him, haven't you, and for very good reasons.
Well, of course, he changed so much.
Yes, they do.
When he started, he was just a sort of tough cop. And I realised when I knew that I was going to write more, because he was becoming quite popular, that I would have to make him more acceptable, not so much to my readers as to me, because I was stuck with him, wasn't I, as one is.
Yes,
and I wanted him to be somebody I liked. So I made him more liberal, more literate, more interesting, more sensitive. And of course, what happened was, not so much that he became different, but that he became more like me. And also, more like my father. Then I'm like my father. I'm not sorry for that, because it means that all the things I believe in and think about and handle and deal with are things that Wexford does too. So he is my mouthpiece, and that's all right.
Isn't that just marvellous? It's like the lost scene from The Importance of Being Earnest. Ruth Rendell and P.D. James in discussion with each other at the Cheltenham Literary Festival in the UK in 2009. And P.D. James died in November last year, and we heard over the weekend the sad news that Ruth Rendell has also died at the age of 85. Her most recent book is The Girl Next Door. It was published last year. I gather there's another one in the pipeline still to come, but she had no plans to retire, so isn't that very sad? Ruth Rendell, dead at the age of 85. That's music from Korea, and it's just the thing to transport us to the little town of Clunes, which is in the goldfields country of central Victoria, where I've just spent an absolutely fabulous weekend. Now, the main street in Clunes is like a movie set for a bygone era, and for one weekend every May, this past weekend, the town becomes Booktown, and thousands of people travel there to rummage through secondhand bookstores and galleries, and they go to talks. They have a great time. And a highlight of this year's Booktown was an intriguing exhibition of photographs. Now, the story of this show starts with a photographer named George Rose, and as the writer Rodney Hall told me, Rose was born in Clunes. This is back in 1861. And a century ago, he's the most intrepid fellow, a century ago he travelled all around the world taking photographs, stereo photographs, photographs for postcards, wonderful stuff. And in 1904, he visited the very reclusive country of Korea. And his photos of Korean life today are a really precious historical record for Koreans who don't otherwise have this record of what their country looked like 100 years ago. Well, in honour of Rose's work in Korea, two really famous contemporary photographers, Australia's William Yang and Korea's Koo Bon Chang, have been taking photographs of Korea and of Clunes, and it's their photos which are on show in this exhibition. And there's a lovely twist to this story. Clunes is a sister town to Paju Book City in South Korea, and this is a remarkable government-funded project which has spawned a multi-million dollar printing industry, and we'll hear about that too. So let's you and I now head to Clunes to the sound of the Creswick Brass Band, who are playing to the crowd outside. So here we are, as I say, in the town of Clunes in central Victoria, and we're in the most lovely church. There's a hymn board up there, and you can sit up there in the balcony and listen to the word of God being preached. But it's all been cleared out for an exhibition. Let's start by finding out what this is all about. It starts with a photographer called George Rose. And George Rose is a man that you and I should know a lot more about. And Rodney Hall, Australian novelist, man about town, knows all about this guy.
Yeah, George Rose. I mean, this is the most neglected photographer in our history, I should think, because he was astonishing. And he had an enormous output, and he was very famous among postcard buyers and stereograph buyers 100 years ago.
Yeah, now, my grandmother had a stereograph in her house that you look at these wonderful stereo photographs. Yeah. I don't know whether they were Rose photographs, because I was 10 years old and I didn't note the photographer's name, but they were this kind of thing.
The guy had a fantastic eye, and he took photographs in Korea in 1904 when everything else was being destroyed. And we came across them through the Department of Foreign Affairs when I did a festival in Seoul and engaged a marvellous Korean photographer, Koo Bon Chang, who is here now, wonderful photographer, who's put this exhibition together with a wonderful photographer of our own, William Yang, and they've done a really exquisite job of this small exhibition. But it's all in honour of Rose and what Rose did in 1904 in Korea.
And in showing Korea to the rest of the world, I guess that's the point, because Korea is a country that people mightn't even have heard of.
Yeah, it was called the Closed Kingdom, the Hermit Kingdom at the time.
And William's here.
I'm thrilled with the exhibition, the way it's come together as a kind of cultural exchange, really, between Paju Book Town, Paju Book City and Clunes Book Town. So these Australia.
So William Yang, these are, what do they call them? Cousin cities or sister cities or
sister
something?
Sister cities, yes. And it's the thing that they're book cities that they've become sister cities. I photographed the Korea on the walls, and Bo Chang has photographed Clunes. And I've actually photographed a wider career than just Pardew Book City. So
what's the story you think your photographs tell about Korea?
I just photographed what I saw and what I liked. And in some ways, I like the traditional Korea. There's a lot of photographs of a sort of style of architecture, which is quite old. But also, I just photograph life and meals I ate, just the experiences that I had, staying at the traditional inn, visiting Pardew Book City and eating at restaurants.
You've got a fantastic photograph of Pardew Book City. One of them there is just this enormous room, beautiful room, contemporary timber room with shelves going all the way to the ceiling. Perhaps we could just explain to Australia the improbable project, which is the Pardew Book City.
Pardew Book City is a town that's about 10 years old. It's a custom-built town purely for book production. There are 600 book companies there. There are printers, and there's an old printery, which is the only printery that does movable type in Korea. That's hand-placed keys. And at the hotel, there's this wall-to-wall. It's like a huge library set. It's really like something out of a film. And each Sunday, the parents bring their children to the hotel so that they can read the books. And it's lovely seeing all these kiddies running around reading books.
And Rodney Hall, the improbable thing about this city is that it was funded by the government.
Well, yes, it was subsidised by them because a little group of businessmen who were publishers had their connections. Everything's done with who you know. They had their connections with government, and they went to the government with a bright idea of making Korea a Seoul, the world centre of intellectual property, and that they're going to do that by being the most efficient producers of hard copy books. And they said, all we need is a huge block of land, tax-free, and we, as commercial enterprises, will put the buildings up ourselves. And the government kind of said, oh, OK. It's enormous. You can't believe how huge it is, Michael.
And are they making money, I suppose?
They're making heaps and heaps and heaps of money. Much to everyone else in the world's surprise.
Yes. So, Woon Chang, you came here to Clunes with your camera, back to the home of George Rose. Yeah. What did you see? What caught your photographer's eye?
Yeah, I really didn't visit a small town before in Australia. I was once in Sydney or Melbourne, but in small town first time. But I really surprised of this warmness of the people and also different scenery. Even I could learn the history of gold mining and all the 1860s story, historical background in Australia. It was a wonderful chance for me. And I would like to maybe show some of small elements that normal daily life they didn't notice, but through my camera, if they can notice the beauty of their country or their small town or even the people's face or their character through my camera, if they can realize once again, it will be very happy for me.
Is that what photography is for you? Is photography about helping other people see the things they might otherwise miss?
Yes. If I could do that, it will be wonderful. I always try to catch the images, which usually normal people could not notice.
William, is that your mission as well, or do you see your role differently? The idea that you're there as the photographer to help us see those little things, those moments of life that perhaps the rest of us might miss.
That is a very big part of my photography, is my trust in my own sensibility to see something extraordinary, often in very ordinary things, but also in extraordinary things, seeing the obvious, that some extraordinary things are extraordinary, and to just capture it.
And you're also not afraid to put yourself in the picture.
Yes, I suppose from doing performance pieces, there's an element running through all my photography which is autobiographical. And so it's my journey through life And so I'm telling people that this is what it was like to stay at the traditional inn and sleep on a hard pillow for the night.
I like that aspect of your work because it's a kind of bearing witness.
Yes,
I was here,
right.
I saw these things, I did these things. So, Bunchang, two of the images that help us see things we might otherwise overlook here in Clunes that I particularly like of yours are one we're looking at now, which is just two tea caddies. Yeah. There's one with a kangaroo on it and one with an emu on it, and they're facing each other almost as though they're on the Australian coat of arms.
Yeah, yeah.
Where did you find these two lovely old tea caddies?
I found this tin caddy in the Clunes Museum. There is a museum of collecting all the historical objects. And one corner, it's really abandoned corner, but I found small tea caddy. And I really surprised the typical Australian animals. So I really captured the images, and it's really wonderful to see animals again in an old time-preserved tea caddy.
Yeah. The other photo I particularly like is the one that's alongside it. And you found a shop here in the main street of Clunes which has two identical doors.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you've photographed these two identical doors with these lovely glass windows between them, and then you've divided it in two as though it's an old stereographic photograph.
Yeah. Sometimes I faked like as if it was took by the stereograph technique, but it's one. Sometimes I use just one images, but looks like a stereograph. But in this particular image, I am very happy that it looks like two images, but it's really two doors, and the show window goes on like that.
So by the time we go to air, sadly, this exhibition will be over because it's only here for 2 days. This magical moment, it's like fairies come to your garden and they create something that lasts for 2 days. Where will it go next, William?
It's going to Paju Book City and also to the Australian Career Foundation in Seoul, and it's also coming back to Sydney, we hope, to the Korean Foundation in Sydney.
Well,
it might even come to Melbourne. We're giving it a push now we're here.
All right, you've got my complete backing. And meanwhile, Rodney Hall, the other thing that you and I should do is think about how we're going to make this man, George Rose, more famous.
Yes, we have to. And I think it is a matter of selection. The big problem with a photographer like this, Michael, is there's thousands and thousands of glass negatives that, you know, you have to be able to assess the negative.
Yeah.
And it's just going to take somebody, some dedicated person, to go through it and make selections and all that process that other photographers have had done for them by students and lecturers. So we've got to resurrect him. And he's a precious commodity. It's this is early for Australian photography, and it's of very, very high quality.
And that sound you can hear is William Yang taking my photograph. I'm honoured. I've just been photographed by a famous photographer. That's the joy of Books and Arts. We get to meet all these marvellous people. Novelist Rodney Hall, William Yang, and Koo Bon Chang, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule here at Clunes.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael. Great.
It's a big finish there from the Creswick Band, who played so spiritedly through that weekend. And we were talking to the photographers William Yang and Koo Bon Chang. He's from Korea. And also with us the writer and very energetic promoter of Australian stories, Rodney Hall. And that show is called The Spirit of George Rose. If you're in Korea, well, you might catch it there because that's where it's off to next. It's beautifully curated by Catherine Kroll. Now, thanks to all of you who've tweeted in after our curationism story at the top of the show. We had a chat to the art critic David Balzer about the act of curating, which he reckons has jumped the art fence and is now out in the world. Anyone can be a curator, apparently. Rosalind Grundy has tweeted in, chefs even curate artisan and heritage ingredients now. I remember when they just cooked them. Me too, Rosalind. And Heraclea, who often gets in touch with us, has tweeted about our other guest today, the wood engraver David Fraser. She says, exquisite work, an underappreciated medium, tactile, human, just beautiful, because that's the way we talk on Twitter, in short little grabs. Thank you, Heraclea. I couldn't agree with you more. And remember, if you missed any of today's interviews, you can subscribe to the Books and Arts podcast, as thousands do all over the world. Just head to our website for details. And tomorrow you can hear or podcast or listen to on your phone, Copy Fight. That's the title of a new book in which artists and writers talk about what copyright means to them and to their work. And we'll also have a chat to a wonderful scriptwriter named Joe Penhall. He grew up as an Aussie, but England has given him the kind of career which is still impossible here. And yeah, he's a terrific talker. So we'll meet him tomorrow. Now, if you're based in Melbourne, I'd love you to come along to a special event that we're holding tomorrow night. I'll be in conversation with Catherine Brisbane, the theatre critic and publisher, to launch her latest platform paper, which is called Arts and the Common Good. And she tackles some really tough issues for the arts in Australia, especially how we fund the arts and whether, in fact, arts should be expected to sort of stand on their own two feet. That's tomorrow night at 6 p.m. at our ABC studios at Melbourne South Bank. It's a ticketed event, just $15, and all the details are on our website. Earshot is next. We're looking at why more and more people are adopting a boating life on the canals of England and why the two-party political system is crumbling across the UK. That's coming up straight after the news. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN. Toodaloo.